can invite himself anywhere he wants to be.
It's true, but I'm not.
So what bill are you going to address?
I'm just going to talk the PE bill.
Well, let me know if there's any PE bill. Like it, don't like.
Peter?
We're going to call to order the Senate Education. Today is April 11th, 2017. We have a large crowd of people. Just so you know, we have a group of bills we're going to do early, because there's not a lot of conversation on those. Then we're going to do some work sessions, then we're going to come back to the last two bills. So we're going to start out with a public hearing on Senate Bill 4. And we will carry over the work session on Senate Bill 4 to Thursday. So with that, we're going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 4. Senator Courtney. And we'll have a short explanation of the bill and the amendment that came out late, so we don't have all the paperwork for it yet.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, the Dash 2 amendment replaces the measure.
Just a little bit of it.
Okay. The amendment allows sixth graders who attend K through sixth grade schools to take physical education for 150 minutes each week and requires sixth graders who attend sixth through eighth grade schools to take physical education for 225 minutes per week. It requires the State Board of Education to adopt rules relating to the proration of time requirements. It allows school districts to prorate time requirements under certain circumstances, makes many changes to the way the minutes are calculated. Allows up to 45 minutes of activities each week to satisfy the time requirement if those activities meet academic content standards for physical education and are provided by a teacher whose license allows. It allows teachers with an elementary multiple subject endorsement to instruct students in physical education activities if the activities are reviewed by a teacher with a physical education endorsement. It requires the Oregon Department of Education to review and approve activities developed by nonprofit organizations and make a list of approved activities available to school districts and public charter schools. It requires ODE to collect data, provide technical assistance, and develop recommendations. It allows school districts and public charter schools to provide activities developed by nonprofit organizations even if those activities are not on the approved list. It institutes a hold harmless period until the end of the 2022-23 school year in which school districts may not be considered non-standard for not meeting the physical education requirements. The amendment establishes a transition period, declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2017.
So, with that, Senator Courtney.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthicum, and Senator Haas, Senator Cruz, Senator Geltzer, members of the august, esteemed Senate Committee on Education. My name is Peter Courtney. I'm a state senator, District 11, which is here in Salem. And I'm here to testify for Senate Bill 4, which is, for me, a decade, 10-year effort. Regular physical activity is important for our kids. Actually, it's important for us all, but this is about kids. It keeps them healthy, and it keeps them happy, and it keeps them involved and engaged. Physical education helps children maintain healthy weight, strong bones. It reduces the risk of obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. It reduces anxiety and depression. Put simply, it's very good for a child's mental health. Studies show that regular physical activity at school benefits children's academic performance. Kids who are active have higher grades and better test scores. They pay attention to academic tasks. They have better memory and recall. Active children are even less likely to act out. Another way of putting it, get into trouble. This is why it is so important that we ensure that physical education is being taught in our Oregon schools. Which is why 10 years ago, the legislature passed what was then House Bill 3141. This established PE minutes requirements for K through 8 schools, at least 150 minutes for elementary schools, and 225 minutes for middle schools. Something that many of you have reminded me of in very not so pleasant terms, since no other course, if I'm told, has minute requirements in our educational system. We gave school districts 10 years to implement these requirements. They go into effect this July. And according to a recent review, only 10% of Oregon schools are currently meeting these requirements. Only 10%. I'm very torn on this issue. On one hand, I feel that 10 years is more than long enough. School districts knew this was coming and should have been working towards these goals. On the other hand, 90% of Oregon schools are losing their standards this July may be a bit extreme. The 2000 bill also directed schools and OD, Oregon Department of Education, to do this. Clearly, that was not enough. This bill lays out a specific timeline and steps that schools and Oregon Department of Education will have to take to meet these requirements. Now, I'm going to be very careful how I make my final statements here. I'm not that happy to be here today. And I'm tempted to walk away from this and make school districts deal with the consequences of not meeting these standards. But my wife has come into my life on this issue as recently as this morning, a former PE teacher at Whitaker Junior High School. It was a long time ago, and coach, the most crowded junior high school in the state at the time. As well as my staff, who sits immediately to my left, who've made it very clear to me that the PE advocates have been working hard on this issue. They have worked with the school districts to come to a solution that will ensure that Oregon students will have PE minutes they need and deserve. I don't know if the last two amendments of this bill are the final amendments, but hopefully it is the beginning of an end of a process that started 10 years ago. To be frank with you, I don't know, and that's why I've asked that the work session be moved over to next week. I don't know if I can be there today by 5 o'clock or even in the next day or two, because this suspends the bill in effect for 2 years. I'm not going to get into the details that was read by your committee administrator. That bothers me profoundly, and because I don't have the trust element here that I should have, I just don't know. But I am aware that an 8 month or plus effort went into this. I was not involved in the effort directly. My staff was. I know it was very difficult, very torturous, the exercise that went on. They weren't always pleasant exchanges. And I also know to talk about blame just doesn't work, and et cetera, et cetera. But the fact is, this is a very serious thing. The law will go effect in July. As I understand it, there can be some defunding involved in terms of sanctions if the law isn't met. It could get very serious, because the law was an amazing piece of legislation we passed 10 years ago. I don't really know how we did it, given the attitude that I've run into in people over these last 10 years. This is a very serious issue. If you don't believe me, then you should check with the medical community about children's activity, particularly in today's society. It is extremely serious. We can talk about reading, writing, and arithmetic, but if a kid isn't paying attention or can't pay attention or can't focus, then it's just an intellectual exercise that adults like to go through about how important the basic reading and writing and arithmetic is when the child's just not absorbing anything. So this isn't just pie in the sky. This isn't just Peter Rant and Raven. This is real. I'm in front of a committee, some of whom have extraordinary backgrounds in education, no less than the great principal of Marshfield High School. And, you know, I understand that you can say you didn't fund it, you're responsible, you're no good. I've heard it all. I know it all. I've been through the torture chamber on this one. There is not a belief in our school system, or even by many people who work in the school system or school boards, that this stuff is that important or as important as this other thing. A healthy body, healthy mind, a healthy mind, a healthy body, the nuns used to tell me. So I thank you for letting me do my tirade. Incredible effort went into this by people who really want this, as well as the school district and the Department of Education. If I were smart, I'd just accept the amendments. I may capitulate, but I'm not capitulating at this moment in front of this committee.
Fair enough. Did the wonderful person sitting next to you wish to make a comment?
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, just checking. Any questions for the Senate President? You made yourself clear. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, we will bring up Morgan Allen and Christina Bottomer. Bottomer. He doesn't want it out of here. Yes, put it over so we've already put the work session over. He hasn't agreed with himself.
Just don't have it. Okay.
You don't have work stuff.
Good afternoon, Chair Roble and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christina Bottomer, and I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Heart Association for Oregon. And I'm also here today as the Chair of the Physical Education for All Kids Coalition in support of Senate Bill 2 and the Dash 2 Amendment. The Physical Education for All Kids, or PEAK Coalition, is comprised of community-based organizations, advocates, parents, educators, and health professionals who, for the last decade, have been and continue to be deeply committed to improving PE and wellness in Oregon schools. Senator Courtney already touched base on some of the health benefits of PE, but really it provides not only students an opportunity for physical activity in their school day, but it teaches students the basics of physical literacy and how to integrate exercise into their lives to establish a lifetime of healthy living. Children who are more active learn more effectively and achieve more academically, making physical education an integral part of developing the whole child for success in social settings and the learning environment. The last 10 years have presented numerous challenges for our education system that have prevented most schools from being able to take the necessary steps to be prepared to provide PE at its now mandatory levels. Knowing that the deadline was rapidly approaching, the coalition was approached by the senator and the education advocates to sit down and try to talk things out, which we have done very diligently for the last 9 months. The results of that discussion are represented in SB4 and the Dash 2 Amendment. Honestly, the last 9 months, as the senator mentioned, have involved a lot of challenging concessions that have been made by both sides. But all parties remained at the table dedicated to creating a path forward. Our schools hold an evidence-based opportunity to increase physical activity in our youth, and as children are more likely to get the recommended amount of PE if they live in our state, like Oregon, with policies that mandate activities, our expectation is now that with the passage of the Dash 2 Amendment, Oregon will finally be on a path to providing meaningful standard-based physical education for our elementary and middle school students.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. Morgan Allen on behalf of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators and the other folks in the K-12 advocacy organizations. As been stated, we've spent the last 9 months taking a look at the 2007 PE law and having a lot of good conversations, and I think it's fair to say the Dash 2 amendments reflect a compromise that recognizes the current fiscal challenges for schools and, we hope, offers a reasonable path to ensuring that Oregon students receive recommended levels of instruction in physical education. And I've submitted written testimony that I'll briefly touch on, and I just wanted to highlight the major components of the amendment because, as the committee administrator noted, it is complicated. But the first piece in the bill, and I also on the testimony I submitted in writing, I noted where these are in the bill, so you can go to the lines or the pages if you like. But the first thing is it creates a new implementation timeline, and as the Senate President mentioned, a 2-year delay and then an additional 4-year phase-in of the PE requirements. The second component is it makes some important technical changes. When the law was originally passed, the minutes were inflexible, and by that I mean if a school district, let's say it's Thanksgiving week or you have to close a couple days for inclement weather or you're doing field trips, you still would be responsible for providing the entirety of the minutes every single week. regardless of how many school days you had. So this allows the department to prorate those, you know, holiday weeks, inclement weather, schools on four-day weeks, and things like that. As was mentioned earlier, because this is the only subject that has minutes in statute, we needed to create a safety valve that would allow school districts to fall below the minutes in recessionary times. Without that safety valve, let's say we had another great recession and schools were facing pretty significant cuts again, we would not be able to make any reductions to PE, which would amplify the reductions in other areas. So that was another component of the bill. One of the, I think, real important breakthroughs in the work group discussion was we got really creative about implementing around elementary and looked at the teacher licensure standards and came with a 45-minute flexibility so that our classroom teachers who are allowed to teach PE to their own classroom cohorts could do some team activities or structured recesses or other types of things that meet the PE standards to help school districts meet those minute requirements. And then the last thing, and probably the most important thing in the bill, at least in my opinion, is we put in place a process to continue our conversations and collaboration towards implementing the middle school requirements at PE. And I think everyone involved in these discussions for the last 9 months would acknowledge that PE in middle school was our toughest nut to crack, and that's why we want to continue those conversations and look at a phase-in over the next 9 months in partnership with all the PE stakeholders, school districts, and the Department of Education. So we urge your adoption of the Dash 2 amendments, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So any questions from this group? Okay, thank you very much. So we're going to close the work session, and just so that I remind people, we did carry over the work session to Thursday. So close that one. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 704, and we'll have a short explanation, and we'll call up Johnny Corbin and Neil Schroeder. Okay.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 704 establishes program requirements for community classrooms. Defines community classrooms as combined work and educational experiences for high school students available through partnerships between local businesses and school districts.
Mr. Corbin, welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Johnny Corbin. I'm a father, grandfather, a U.S. Navy submarine veteran, a graduate from California State University, Long Beach, with a degree in industrial arts, a vocational educator, and a current member of the Redmond School Board. As the last bill was put through, I will be a proud member of the school board to tell you that our school district does very well in our physical education department, and I've had the luxury to visit all of our schools and know that is done very well. Just as a short little thing I put in as a submariner, April 11th, 1900, the United States Navy bought its first submarine, the USS Holland, and today it's the birthday of the submarine force, which I'm a very proud member of being a former submariner. The bill that I brought for you today has to deal with vocational education. I've been a vocational educator, like I expressed in the past, and I was a part of a program called the Regional Occupational Program. Last November, the voters passed Proposition 98, and when I look at the bill, I really didn't see a lot of framework. So I've had this bill in the hopper for maybe 25 years, and I feel it's an appropriate time to bring it to the forefront. Basically, what this bill does, it takes and puts a young high schooler into a community classroom, and that's what this bill does, is explain what a community classroom does. We have a lot of vocational classes in the Redmond School District, and I'm very proud of the programs that we have, but there really has not been any framework for some of the programs that we don't have. With this bill, what it does, it basically gives the community the luxury of taking a young person and shadowing an employee so they can get some experience in a vocational vocation. The scope of the program covers almost all the vocational programs. My area happened to be automotive. So when I did the program, I had youngsters in body shops. I had them in dealerships. I even had one at the city yard. I had them in fleet agencies. I had dealerships, parts stores, specialty stores, and in other programs in this vocational program, they even had a, what do you want to call it, a program that did no, just escape my mind a minute. Flower arrangement type situations. So as you can see, the vocational programs really runs the gamut. When I went and visited the employers, the biggest objection that they had was liability. And what I would suggest is that the schools or the state pick up the liability. And when I presented that to the employers, I only had one employer told me no. And I went through a lot of employers, I'll guarantee you that. With that, the employers must meet or exceed all the OSHA standards. So that kind of broke down all the barriers. So when a student goes out into the community classroom, they have an idea whether they're going to be suited for this type of vocation or not. If they are, hey, that's great. They can pursue it to the next level. At the same time, they can earn high school credits and a grade for it. And part of the program is that in order to stay in the program, you have to stay in school. So on the other side of the ledger, that also helps increase the dropout rate down. That's what one of the things that we're really concerned about is keeping the kids in school. So this gives them another form of a reason to stay in school. So with that, I can say that with my experience as a vocational educator, it's a win-win-win situation for all of our kids.
Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Yeah, any questions? I'll just make one statement. My father taught the same program in Port Angeles, Washington. He had a vocational carpentry class, but besides this vocational carpentry class, he was the instructor that went out and found those businesses to find places for people. I agree with you. I think it is one of those things that works really well in our society to give kids an opportunity to figure out what's happening and to learn and to progress and help with graduation. So, but we are not going to move the bill today because I do hope that this conversation continues in Ways and Means and others as we start looking at how to do what you said, fix Measure 98. Because
the biggest thing to remember is that school districts have limited amount of money.
Yep.
With this program, what I would suggest is if a school district, in fact, my superintendent says, don't make it mandatory and don't make it cost us anything.
That's right.
But what I would recommend is that if a school district opts to go into this particular type of program, make it on a grant form. That way it fulfills all the requirements that you're looking for. The voters are saying, well, you're funding it, but it's not through the normal education process. And we're not have to stretch our school district budgets. Like I said, I'm on school board, so I know about those kind of things, to have additional programs that are really are effective and are really a great program.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Yep. As you're going, I will say that it does take part of a teacher who understands how to work with all those other people to make it work. So obviously you were able to do that in your past. So thank you again. And with that, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 704. And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 578. And we'll have, I guess, Bill, are you still here for 578, or is that?
I'm here.
Okay, there you go.
Senate
Thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the Senate Education Committee. I'm here to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 578. It has a sister bill, which is House Bill 2730-63. The bill is mainly focused on encouraging and facilitating National Board Certification of teachers. National Board Certification, at least in my research, is basically standards that are set by teachers themselves, and they're trying to increase the or to help teachers excel and to become masters of their craft. It's been likened to the Hippocratic, basically setting the Hippocratic Oath standard for teachers, whereas the Hippocratic Oath is for doctors. Essentially, the bill, we have an amendment to the bill, which is the Dash 1 amendment, and it essentially makes 578 into 2763, which has a lot more details about facilitating funding and things like that to provide incentives for teachers and extra pay and things like that. So ultimately, the goal is to help facilitate the progression of our education workforce, to make teachers better paid because they're doing jobs that are incredibly critical, and they're working with students who need teachers that are highly trained, and Oregon has great teachers, but we can make them all even greater. So ultimately, we're just trying to get the bill amended and act as a vehicle to help spur the conversation and keep that the effort going to facilitate National Board Certification of more teachers in Oregon. I think as it currently stands, that only 1% of licensed teachers in the state have achieved National Board Certification, and we should at least aspire to 10%. It'd be great if we could have more people than that, but ultimately we want to get our foot in the door and encourage teachers to increase their training, and we also want to compensate them commensurate with that extra training. So I don't really have much beyond that to say. If you have any questions or comments, I'm happy to field them. But beyond that, I don't want to take more of your time because you have a huge committee.
Yes, so. We do.
So any questions for this witness? Seeing none, we're going to close. Unless there's anybody else that wanted to speak to it, don't see anybody. We're going to close the public hearing on which one we got?
578.
Senate Bill 578. As was mentioned, this bill does have a counterpart in the House, which has already moved, so we're not going to move this bill. It already talked. So But we wanted to have the hearing on this side so that if something happens, both sides have heard about it. So
exactly.
Thank you very much.
Exactly. Thanks.
Next, I'm going to let people know that Senate Bill 196 and Senate Bill 209, Senate Bill 253, and Senate Bill 2759 and Senate Bill 353 will be moved to Thursday. So if you were here for those, they're moved to Thursday. The work group sessions have been moved to Thursday.
Would you do the list one more time?
Yep, so I will. 196, mm-hmm. 209, 253, 759, and 353. There's certain paperwork that has to be done, and some of these, that paperwork was not ready. So the RIS and FIS have to be there. And other ones, we've had requests from members up here to actually put it off for a little so they could get some more information. So that's why those are moving. So with that, we're going to open a work session. We'll come to the other two bills in a few minutes. But we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 111. And we'll have a short explanation of the bill, and then we'll move forward.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, the Dash 2 amendment for Senate Bill 111 replaces the bill's statutory provisions, requires the Oregon Department of Education to develop and administer a pilot program to assist school districts and education service districts in increasing the use of Medicaid billing, establishes program requirements.
And we have a Dash 2 amendment, so Senator Lithicum.
Chair Roblin, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendment dated 3/16 of 2017.
Senator Lithgow moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated March 16th, 2017. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So moved. Senator Lithgow.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 111 as adopted with the Dash 2 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
There's, Senator Lithicum moves Senate Bill 111 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be sent to Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion of the motion? Any opposition of the motion? It passed, so it's on its way to the Ways and Means Committee. Senate Bill 138, we are not going to have a work session, and we are not putting it off, so just so people know. Senate Bill 221. We're going to open a public hearing on a work session on Senate Bill 221. Have a short explanation of the bill.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 221 revises state law relating to teacher training programs and dyslexia. It adds provisions requiring teacher training programs to provide instruction on other reading difficulties as well as dyslexia. It requires educator preparation programs for early childhood education, elementary education, special education, or reading to provide instruction on dyslexia and other reading difficulties. It removes provisions of state law requiring teacher preparation programs to follow the standards of an international dyslexia association, and it allows educator preparation programs to phase in compliance with standards or rules adopted by the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission over 3 years. It declares an emergency effective on passage. The Dash 1 amendment reinstates provisions of state law requiring teacher education programs dyslexia education to match the standards of an international organization.
It also has a portion that postpones for 2 years the Oh, did you? Okay, I missed that. So this is conforming with a group of people who met together to make sure that the dyslexia bills continue and to give TSPC the time to implement some other standards for higher education, which they asked for 2 years. So is there, Senator Lithicum?
Chair Roblin, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated April 3rd of 2017.
Senator Lithicum moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated April 3rd, 2017. Is there any further discussion? Any opposition to the amendment? So moved. Senator Lithicum.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 221 as amended with the Dash 1 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation. No further referrals.
Senator Lithicum moves Senate Bill 221 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So moved, and I will carry. I have to look at my two different notes.
Close the work session.
Oh, and I'll close the work session on, thank you very much, Senate Bill 221. That's done. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 280. We'll have a short explanation of the bill.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 280 appropriates an unspecified amount of money to the Department of Education for the biennium beginning July 1st, 2017, for the purpose of developing academic content standards for Oregon Studies and supporting teacher training and classroom instruction in Oregon Studies. Declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2017.
So, Senator Lithicum, is there is no amendment?
No amendments.
Okay. This one's going to go to Ways and Means. So, Senator Lithicum.
Yeah, it has an amendment. It has a referral on it. So, Chair Roblin, I will move Senate Bill 280 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a referral to Joint Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Lithicum moves Senate Bill 280 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. So this bill, Ways and Means will have to decide if there's any money for it, but that'll be the conversation.
And as a policy statement, are we in discussion now?
Yes.
As a policy statement, We're asking these guys to come up with money out of every nook and cranny, and the funding just isn't there. So at some point, this education committee could just say, we'll let it die.
Yeah, I appreciate that. From my, yes.
Yeah, and Ms. Chair, thank you. I agree with Senator Lithcomen, which is why we're sending it without recommendation. Because quite simply, we've sent several measures to Ways and Means. I'm sure the House committees are doing the same thing, sending measures to Ways and Means. And as we all know, the first thing we have to do is fund the core mission of K-12 before we start adding these other things to it. Just on the record.
Okay, so I want to correct that, because we did say do pass on this one. My issue is the fundamental bill that talks about what it is, which is teaching Oregon kids about Oregon, different relations, has already been passed. This is just saying, with no money in it, you decide how much you want to spend.
Yeah, I know.
But we'd like you to spend something. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, I guess that's fine, I suppose, at this point in time. But to a degree, knowing that the money may not be there, we're kind of putting an onus on the Ways and Means Committee, so we can be the good guys and they're the bad guys. So, okay.
I appreciate that. So, any further discussion?
Given the conversation that we're having, I could withdraw that motion and send it with a no recommendation for a pass. If
anybody. I mean, at the end of the day, they have to make the decision, so I'm fine with that.
Right. So
we haven't taken action on the list, so you can make a new motion.
Chair Roblin, I'd like to withdraw my do pass recommendation on the prior motion.
Okay. So it works.
So I will move Senate Bill 280 with no recommendation, with a referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Okay.
By prayer.
Senator Lithcomb moves Senate Bill 280. To the Ways and Means Committee with no recommendation by prior reference. However that goes. Any discussion on that? Okay. Any opposition? No? We'll send that off to Ways and Means. And we'll close the work session on 280. 353, we've already taken care of. Okay, this one, we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 395. It has to do with.
You've got to close the other one first.
Oh, I did.
Oh, you did?
That
okay.
one I did this time.
I wasn't paying attention.
We're
going to
open a work session on Senate Bill 395. I'll have a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 395 requires the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, in cooperation with the state's public institutions of higher education, to determine annually the number of current and former foster children enrolled in the institutions and the graduation rate for current and former foster children. The bill requires HEC to make those rates available to the public and to use those rates when conducting annual evaluations of each public university. The Dash 1 amendment removes a reference to Oregon Health and Science University and inserts the Department of Human Services.
So this is a bill to go to Ways and Means to help get a handle on our issues with respect to foster children. Senator Lithcomb, do you want to make a motion?
Chair Roblin, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated March 23rd, 2017.
Senator Lithcomb moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated March 23rd, 2017. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Is there any opposition to the amendment? So moved. So this is another one that's going to Joint Ways and Means, and I think we're trying to send a message that we really want to continue to work on this issue. We've been trying to do this for a long time. Our foster care kids have had a difficult time in our state with respect to being successful. So with that, the letter, Senator Lithcomb.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 395 as amended with the Dash 1 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a referral to Joint Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay, Senator Lithicum moves Senate Bill 395 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that a referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
I'm going to let this one go.
Okay. Is there any opposition? So moved. Thank you.
Well,
we've worked on this one, and I know your case. Okay, yes, I know okay. you care about yes. that particular issue.
We said we had to be consistent.
We're going to close the work session on 395. So. 758. I have different things here. 758. Okay, so we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 758. And we'll have a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 758 establishes a refundable tax credit for contributions to higher education savings network accounts. It establishes tax credits for corporations that contribute to higher education savings network accounts for their employees. It allows taxpayers to subtract set amounts from their taxable income per beneficiary of a higher education savings network account or an account set up under the provisions of the Achieving a Better Life Experience Act. The bill extends tax credits to S corporations for contributions to higher education savings accounts. It'll be effective 91 days after the Legislative Assembly adjourns sine die.
And this one has a subsequent referral to JTAX, which may or may not do anything. So, Senator Lithcomb.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 758 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a referral to Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Senator Lithgow moves Senate Bill 758 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Joint Committee on Tax
Credits. Joint Committee on Tax Credits. Thank you for correcting me. By prior reference. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any opposition? Seeing none. So moved. We now have a few bills that Senator Cruz and I would really like to have go to the first group, to the Rules Committee, because we're going to have a work group on the restructuring of education in the state and have a conversation about it. And if we can get some stuff done this year, we will. If we can't, we're okay. So we'll have a open a work session. Can we do them all of them? We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 649, SJR 37, SB 746. Are you okay with the last one? Okay. And Senate Bill 803.
What about 8?
We have to do them separately.
We have to do them separately.
Okay.
Those are different things.
Oh, okay.
But we will do it.
Okay.
So, Senator Lithcomb.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bills 746, 649, 803, and the Senate Joint Resolution 37 without recommendation back to the President's office for referral to another committee and request that they be referred to the Rules Committee.
Senator Lithgow moves Senate Bills 746, 649, 803, and Senate Joint Resolution 37 without recommendation back to the President for referral to another committee with the request that they be referred to the Rules Committee. Any discussion? Any opposition? So moved. Close the work session on
all of that.
All that. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 8. And we have an amendment to that one. So, Senator Lithicum.
Oh, okay.
We'll have a short explanation of it.
Yeah. Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Bill 8 allows a community college and a public university to merge if the Higher Education Coordinating Commission approves. It requires merging institutions to submit a joint proposal to HEC that meets certain requirements. It requires HEC to submit a report to the legislature at least 90 days prior to the effective date of the merger. It removes certain provisions of state law, including the requirement that community colleges be located within commuting time of a majority of students, the prohibition on community colleges offering baccalaureate degrees, and the prohibition on spending state funds for dormitories or athletic facilities for spectator sports on community college campuses. The Dash 1 amendment clarifies that ORS 341.009 does not apply to merged institutions. It removes provisions lifting the prohibition on community colleges offering four-year degrees.
Okay. So, Senator Lithcomb.
Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated February 1st of 2017. That was the first day of session.
It was. Senator Lithcomb moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated February 1st, 2017 to Senate Bill 8. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So moved. Senator Lithcomb.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 8 as amended with the Dash 1 amendment without recommendation back to the president's office for referral to another committee with the request that that be referenced to the Rules Committee.
Senator Lithicum moves Senate Bill 8 as amended without recommendation back to the president for a referral to another committee with the request that it be referred to the Rules Committee. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So moved. We'll close this work session on Senate Bill 8. That takes care of all of those. We will now come back to a public hearing on Senate Bill 1038.
Senator Riley.
Okay, and Senator Riley's here. Senate Bill 1038.
So I'd like to bring Senator Sarna.
Absolutely, that would be fine.
This is a candidate for him.
That's good. I like that.
Okay. I missed it.
Probably inappropriate, but what the heck.
As usual.
Short explanation of the bill.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1038 requires high school students to correctly answer at least 60% of the questions on a naturalization test required for United States citizenship in order to earn a high school diploma. It applies to high school diplomas awarded on or after July 1st, 2018. The Dash 2 amendment clarifies that students would need to correctly answer at least 60 out of 100 questions on a civics test derived from the questions used for the civics portion of the naturalization test created by the United States Citizenship and Immigration Service.
So, with that, Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chuck Riley, Senate District 15, and I really like this bill. It was brought to me by Senator Starr, and when I saw this, I said, "This is a great bill. Let's do it." So we have, as you pointed out, amended it one time to make it more clear for the school districts what the intention is. But I'm going to let the good senator describe it better. It's really his bill, I'm just the carrier.
Senator Starr.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to testify this afternoon. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr, and I live in Hillsboro, Oregon. I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 1038 on behalf of the Civics Education Initiative, and I'm really grateful for the support and the commitment of my friend Senator Riley to use a priority bill to sponsor this bill. The Civics Education Initiative was created in 2014 by the Joe Foss Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization focused on closing the civics education gap and preparing America's youth for civic engagement. So I wanted to make sure you understood that. As you all know, elections have consequences. Sometimes we like the outcome of elections, and sometimes we don't. In 2010, I'm sure Senator Riley was less than pleased with the election results in that year. And I can assure you in 2014 that when Senator Riley bested me, I wasn't particularly happy about it. But I can tell you that when it comes to ensuring the next generations of Oregonians or Americans have a clear understanding of U.S. civics, history, and geography, Senator Riley and I absolutely agree. And as a state, we must do better. And as you can tell, this isn't a partisan issue. Republicans and Democrats both agree that preparing the next generation of Americans and Oregonians to intelligently participate in our democratic republic is extraordinarily important. An educated electorate will make better, more informed decisions about their future and really ensuring the continuance of our great system of government that we have. I'm not going to read my entire testimony. I've scratched out lots of paragraphs, and I recognize kind of where we are in the legislative calendar. But I do have a few points that I want to make sure I make and get on the record. And then I will submit the testimony electronically so it'll show up as soon as the staff can get it posted. But Senate Bill 1038 contains a very simple idea. Before a student attending a public school in Oregon receives a high school diploma, the student must pass the United States Citizenship Test, the civics portion of it. That's the 100 questions that is available online. It's easy to find. It's a simple tool, really. That's what it is, a tool to test that these students understand the basic level of U.S. civics. The test is available online. There's no limit to the number of times that a student can take the test. The goal, ultimately, is to have the student pass. And passage of the citizenship test is a 60% pass rate, so 60 out of 100. I think we've all seen those, you know, embarrassing man on the street interviews on late night TV where Americans can't answer basic questions about our government and who we are as a nation. Numerous studies and surveys have shown that the vast majority of Americans, students and really adults, this lack a basic understanding of how our country was founded, how it is governed, and what it means to be a citizen. I have additional information in my testimony, again, that will be online that kind of backs up with some statistics about all of that. By using a well-established test and study materials that are readily available online, this test requirement can be implemented really at no cost to the state or to the local school districts. In fact, there are online lesson plans available for teachers to use. There's online test portals. There's a plethora of online tools available for teachers and for students, for that matter, to ultimately successfully pass this test. Nearly 92% of new immigrants applying for citizenship pass this test on their first attempt. And I think that American students, we shouldn't expect anything less than that. It is our responsibility, just like Thomas Jefferson said, to set an expectation for our students that they know as much about the fundamentals of how our country operates as immigrants are required to know. This isn't a panacea. It's not a silver bullet. There's much more that we can do and can be done to promote civic readiness, but this is an important first step toward ensuring and encouraging civic engagement for our youth. I just want to thank Senator Riley again for sponsoring this important bill. I really appreciate the opportunity to work in a bipartisan fashion on an important issue with him so that we can ensure that as our students graduate schools in Oregon, that they are educated, actively engaged, informed, and ultimately responsible citizens. Based on kind of where we are as a country, where we are as a state, I think that this is the kind of thing that will make an extraordinarily important difference. Moving forward, I would ask for your support. Senator Riley mentioned the Dash 2 amendments, I believe. Those would help to clarify the original intent of the bill. I would ask for your adoption of the amendments and ultimately moving the bill forward. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. And again, I've got some additional information that I will submit to the committee administrator, and it'll show up online in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
If I may, Mr. Chair, one more comment, if I may. I really like this idea, and I've been volunteering with school districts at every opportunity to come to their civics classes and speak, and I want to make sure that I say that again on the air. If you have a civics class that you want me to come and talk to, I'm happy to do that.
Bruce, did you have a question?
I'd like to take the test.
So actually, Senator, that test is available online.
Okay.
And
I
it's really
easy. I need to know
easy.
How to get to it because I'm
yes.
terrible at online stuff.
Right, Senator Courtney and I just took it the other day.
Okay.
And I beat him. I only missed one. He only missed two. So we did it. I hope he's listening.
Yeah, he said that his were the trick questions. And
yeah. We answered the same trick questions.
You know, I think we've lost something over the decades as far as the sort of civics that we learned when we were in school. And I think it's important that, Senator Riley, you're absolutely right. This is very important that kids graduating from schools do know what this country is about and I think this might be a good tool to help us get there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, civicseducationinitiative.org. They have a test online test that you can take there. You Google it. There's other organizations that also have online tests. You can go to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services website and find a copy of the test as well.
Okay.
It's easily available, readily available.
Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Senator Gelser. So I'm pulling up the test. Are there really 100 questions on the test?
Yes, there are.
Follow-up?
Yes.
So my plan in life was to be a high school social studies teacher, so I did the whole thing and actually did it for a little bit. So I'm all for social studies and civics. But if I look at what K-12 kids are struggling with right now, would it really be fair to deny a student a high school diploma and kind of lock them into a lifetime of poverty because they couldn't pass an additional test when maybe they were in a giant class for social studies? Since we don't have required minutes for social studies, it's really hard for kids to get access to those classes, and the consequence for not having a high school diploma is so great. And then the follow-on to that, what about English language learners and students with disabilities for whom these open answered kinds of tests are incredibly difficult? Might that not further decrease the graduation rates of those underserved populations?
So, very good question, Senator. Mr. Chair, Senator Gelser, let me take the first question first. I believe that passing this test, 60% is passing. There's no limit to how many times that a person can take it. The questions never change. They are a set of questions. So my sense is in where this has been adopted, I mean, you have passage rates in the first time in the high 90s. So again, I think that over, I believe that students would ultimately pass this test. As it relates to, you know, special needs kids, English language learners, the test is available in multiple languages, so it doesn't have to be taken in English. So that is helpful as it relates to those issues. And I believe that, again, we can make an accommodation for, you know, the special needs kids. This bill doesn't do that
in its current form,
but perhaps we could adjust that.
Just one follow-up.
Yep.
I think I'm especially sensitive to this issue because I recently have lived with a lot of high school students. I currently am living with two high school students. I have one where we are trying to figure out what to do with her Smarter Balance test because she has a concussion and is not allowed to have screen time, and the anxiety that's causing her around whether or not the fact that she got hit in the head with a soccer ball for the fifth time could jeopardize her high school graduation. When I look at the anxiety that she experiences and to think about adding another thing on top where she throws up in the morning when she thinks about having to do a test and the pressure of, oh my gosh, I'm not going to have a high school diploma and be able to support myself as an adult. I appreciate the intent, but it just seems like a lot to pile on kids that we have piled so much onto already. And I mean, I just see kids with such high degrees of anxiety, so it worries me.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Gelser, obviously you're a lot younger than we are, because we had to do this kind of tests when we were in school, and we made it. We also had to do all the algebra and plane geometry and solid geometry and calculus that everybody has to do now, and we made it. And, you know, I hate to see us not give these students the civics lessons that they need or that I feel they need. Mm-hmm. And the only way you do that is to require it.
Ms.
Follow-up. I appreciate that, and I think it makes sense. I think I look at this, and every once in a while we've got those bills where we have special interest groups at home that won't let us come back. Sometimes it's that we won't get to get elected. I might never be hugged again.
Feel free to vote against
this. Would freak
Senator.
Out my kids.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I just, there's this initiative, this effort has passed in, I think, 15, 16, 17 states. It's an effort underway in 20 states to do this. So we have some experience in where it's passed in a few years. You know, for instance, in Wisconsin, we had passage rate of 99%. We're not mandating how this test is administered. They can take it as a seventh grader. They can take it as a ninth grader. They can take it as a 12th grader. They can take it any point along the way. Again, we don't want to add an additional burden necessarily, or that additional stress necessarily. So there is significant flexibility in how this could be administered at the local level. And based on our experience in the places where this has passed, I want to say the vast majority of kids are passing this test in most of them on their first try. So again, there's not an expectation that kids aren't going to pass. It's like, let's take it until they pass the test.
But even at 99.
We'll let her get that later because we've got a lot of other people.
I understand.
For
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So next we'll have Jan McComb and Andrea Morgan come on up. And keep it as short as you want and shorter than I want. No.
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, I'll get started now.
Good.
As my knee surgery accomplice comes with me. I know you're short of time, so we're here more as a resource, and we wanted to hear what the proponents said about the bill. Jan McComb, Legislative Director for the Department of Education. Andrea Morgan, Social Sciences Specialist. just a couple of things. I took the test right before committee, and one of the questions I got wrong was what political party is the president? And I had just correctly identified the president as Donald Trump. And then it asked me the party, and I said Republican, and it said wrong, Democrat. And so what I'm guessing from some of the other questions asked about, you know, the I think Speaker of the House was Boehner. So some of the questions have been updated, and some of them haven't been, right, is my guess. And so a student who used the practice test might come away with wrong answers.
Wrong answer. Thank you.
And because of that, and because of an unlawful delegation issue, that's when the legislature gives another body control over something that should be a state control issue. If you really want to use this test, you'll probably want to tie it to some date that it existed, and the board probably could do that by rule, and then it would have to update it regularly because these questions and answers change. The effective date, to Senator Gelser's point, when we normally require something new for graduation, we give students enough time to learn the material. And so when we rolled out new higher graduation requirements, we started like 3 years earlier with that group, and so they had time to adjust and earn that. And so you might not want to have an effective date that's right away. You might want to give kids at least a year to learn the material. We were listening to see who would be responsible for administering the test. Would it be the state or would it be the local district? It sounds like the intent is the local district. That's not super clear, but as long as we know that, that can help inform our fiscal. Andrea is pretty familiar with the test, and she could tell you just a little bit more because it turns out that citizens, people studying to be citizens, don't have to take the test.
Well, for the record, I'm Andrea Morgan. I'm the Social Sciences Curriculum Specialist for the Department of Education. And it's not that they don't have to take the test, but they take it in a much different form. The questions are not a 100, you know, question test where they have to get a certain percentage. They are actually given three or four questions that they respond to verbally. And so it's supposed to be part of the idea where they're showing a demonstration that they can speak English. But the other part is that they understand three or four. So they're picked at random out of the 100 questions. So if they respond appropriately, and since they've just redone the citizenship test, they are not multiple choice questions. What they found out is that some of the test preparers were using different vocabulary, and so a person could give a correct answer, but because they used a different vocabulary word, they might have been said that they were incorrect. And so they've expanded it so that they talk back and forth to make sure that they have an understanding. You know, it's given differently if you're going to be naturalized than just simply that 100-question test, which is of a concern to some of our civics educators because we're really trying for a different kind of civic engagement and lesson instead of the kind of, you know, multiple choice, single fact kind of questions that come into this kind of test. So one of the things that they would express is that they're, you know, concerned that maybe we're not really teaching active civics, that we're simply asking them to memorize a list of facts.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. Stay tuned. We have another amendments and things. Next, Richard Donovan and Morgan Allen. And these are the last two, unless anybody else wants to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Richard Donovan on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. I checked opposition to this bill. Strong concerns, opposition. I'm not, you know, there isn't quite a shade of gray on the form, but the school districts have concerns about this bill. The basic concern is that it would align a graduation requirement to a test that districts have no control over and the state does not have any curricular control over. There's concerns, like the department just said a few moments ago, about the nature of the test, how the test has changed recently, the way the test is administered, the access to the information, the standards, how to prepare for the test, all these things that are just totally out of district control. And OSBA has policies and procedures, and one of the number one policies and procedures that our membership adopted also was no unfunded mandates. And this is the kind of thing that districts would really struggle to and would need strong guidance on how to implement. Also, I'd like to echo the Senator's concerns, Senator Gelser's concerns about the potential effects on kind of the traditionally underserved groups and the groups for which there isn't an accommodation for multiple choice online tests. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Morgan Allen here on behalf of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. We share all the concerns that have been raised. And I think fundamentally, this bill feels a little bit callous in the fact that a student could go through high school for 4 years, perform well, meet all of the expectations for credits, and have a stellar resume and be get a 59 on the test at the end of all that and be told that they don't get to graduate with their class. And that just doesn't fundamentally feel right at this point. So thank you.
Any questions of either of these? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we're going to carry over. We don't have the work for this, work session on this bill. And we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1038, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 915. And before I get started, I just wanted to say I've talked to a lot of people about this bill. We've had a work group that worked on this issue all during the interim, and we couldn't come to the final agreements, so we will not be working this bill, but I would like to have input on the bill today in the hearing so that we can look forward to what we're going to do at the next session. So I just want to make sure that it's clear to people so they understand what's happening with Senate Bill 915. And with that, we'll have a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 915 modifies funding amounts school districts must pay to non-virtual public charter schools. It requires school districts to transfer federal, state, and local funds to public charter schools on the same basis funds are distributed to district schools. It allows public charter schools to receive the same reimbursement for transportation costs as school districts. It declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2017.
With that, we'll have Michael Koopman, Glenn Iser, Medessa Cheney. Come on up. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and if we want to hear as many people as we can, try to keep it as brief as you can. And I know that's not easy. So whoever wants to start, let's get going.
I can start. Hi, my name is Michael Koopman. thank you, Chair Roblin, and members of the committee. I'm here to represent the teacher perspective of working at a charter school. I've been working at a charter school for 3 years, and I've stayed because I really believe in the work that we do at our charter school. The teachers are given a lot of freedom for how they're able to teach. We're able to experiment and try new methods that have been very successful over the past 3 years. We're able to use restorative justice practices where we're able to solve conflicts as a community within our classroom that have worked really well. We use project-based learning. We're able to meet standards just like any other school. The hard thing is that our school doesn't have a lot of consistency with staffing, and this is mainly because of pay for teachers. I have to face that as well, because even though I feel very inspired at my school, it's still hard to stay when you're not able to afford paying for a car or the housing in Portland that keeps increasing. So unfortunately, we do not have a strong consistency within our staff. And knowing the teachers and myself, it's usually because of pay.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Senator, Senators and Chairman Roblin. My name is Glenn Iser, and I am the principal of the Woodburn Arthur Academy Charter School. Arthur Academy has six schools, four in Portland, Portland metro area, and one in St. Helens, and my school in Woodburn. So most of our schools are K-5. I'm here this afternoon to speak about the importance and necessity of teacher retention. So retaining our teachers is vital to the overall climate and the success of our schools. Teacher retention allows us to focus more on teaching our students and nurturing our students rather than training new employees. Children thrive with consistency and routine. A children's teacher is one of the most important people in their lives. So they feel safer and more confident learning in an environment that they can depend on. So the reason our staff benefits from teacher retention is obvious. They get to know one another well. They're able to establish camaraderie. They're able to recognize where a colleague might need some extra support. And new teachers can draw on the experience of veteran teachers. Teacher retention also benefits families. When siblings end up having the same teacher, it's a win-win situation. Parents already know their child's teacher. They know what to expect, and relationships are built with a positive effect on the community. So thank you again for giving me the opportunity to speak to you this afternoon about Senate Bill 915.
Thank you.
My name is Medesich.
Move that mic just a little bit over.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's great.
My name is Medessa Cheney, and I'm Vice President of the Board of Directors at Portland Village School, Charter School. Portland Village School opened its doors in 2007 with a mission of providing a Waldorf-inspired education to public school students. Its arts-infused whole child approach has grown into a K-8 community with 400 students, 25 faculty members, and countless dedicated and enthusiastic parents. It's among one of the largest brick and mortar charter schools in Oregon. And it's produced five graduating classes so far with the students going on to a variety of high school settings, public and private around the Portland area, and flourishing in those situations. I'm here to talk about one of my greatest concerns about the future of Portland Village School. As a board member, it's my job to maintain the long-term stability of the organization. And as a parent with four kids at the school, I have a very personal stake in seeing that the school continue to exist. One of the many operational costs associated with running a charter school is facilities, and probably the most daunting one. Charter schools are responsible for finding and paying for their own buildings. And this has been a struggle for the village school since the very beginning. We had to delay opening, in fact, by a year because we could not find a suitable site. We finally found a former Catholic church and school to lease, but it's always been a short-term solution. The property owners have other long-term plans for the property that don't include the village school. Accordingly, many people have worked tirelessly over the years to find our permanent home. We've taken great care to budget conservatively and put aside as much money as possible for this inevitable relocation. In our annual reviews, Portland Public Schools has always commented on the soundness of our financial management. We've fundraised aggressively and looked for every opportunity to reduce costs without sacrificing our mission. Even so, we're at a place where I have serious doubts about our ability to find a site that we can afford when our lease expires 4 years from now. We've looked at every type of possible scenario, and all of them come with price tags that would at least double our current operational costs. Add this to salaries, utilities, rising purse costs, materials, professional development, all the other expenses of operating a charter school, and there's just no way we're going to be able to absorb such a dramatic increase in rent. SB 915 would provide a lifeline to Portland Village School. It would allow us to our thriving community to keep going and to continue offering a uniquely full and meaningful education to public school students. So thank you for your time and your consideration of this.
Thank you. Any questions for this group? Thank you for coming. Next, we're going to have Aaron Cook, Tanya Gebhardt, and Lori Wimmer.
Good
Thank you, Chair Roblin, other members of the committee. My name is Aaron Cook, and I'm the Vice President of the Oregon Digital Leadership Coalition. I'm also the Director of Programs for the Oregon Virtual Academy. It's unfortunate today that I come to oppose this bill because it excludes virtual schools. We are for full funding for charter schools. However, we believe that we should be included in that, and we're surprised that this came forward excluding specifically from participation. Disproportionately, number or students of Oregon virtual schools are at-risk populations who many of the funds above for Title I and other grants of aid are supported. So we actually serve a higher population in many cases than most schools in Oregon of at-risk students that many of these funds are rely on, and we would not have access to them under this bill. At the Oregon Virtual School, 67% of our students, 67% of the students we serve qualify for low income. Recently, INACL did a cost analysis that puts the spending of virtual schools at 110% of brick and mortar equivalents based off of the technology and services needed to fund these fully to their standards. Just lastly, while we agree with the equal funding for charter schools, we feel that our students should be treated equally as charter students. Therefore, we cannot support this bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and the Senate Committee. We appreciate having the time to speak to you. My name is Tanya Gebhardt. I am Deputy Principal at Metro East Web Academy and also an officer of the board of the Oregon Digital Leaders Coalition. And I'm here, although I support the spirit of Senate Bill 915, I oppose as written. We are a virtual charter school, and by excluding us from that bill, really it creates a disproportionate funding source for our schools and like schools. We have about two-thirds of our funding goes towards our teachers and staffing. With the 6 through 8 and Teacher Standard Practices Commission, they've changed their licensure requirements where they are content-based. So for the 6th through 8th grade, we will have to ensure to meet that TSPC requirement that our staff are specific content-based teachers. Therefore, we can't have just one or two elementary or middle school teachers. We need to make sure that we staff accordingly. We also have facilities. Most virtual schools do have a facility, and that represents about 10 to 15% of our funding. And then with the technology infrastructure to ensure that our students have the accessibility to access their curriculum and to be able to work online, that represents another about 10 or 15% of our revenue sources. So by reducing or eliminating us from this particular bill, we feel like we are doing a disservice to our students, and we feel like charter schools exist as an alternative for students who may not find the brick and mortar traditional public schools a great place for their education and are looking for alternative options, and we would like to be included in that as well. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association. It's 44,000 members. We were part of a coalition in 2015 who had concerns about the identical bill then, Senate Bill 819, and came before you. And that set of concerns resulted in the work group that you, Mr. Chair, mentioned that we were participating in all through the last 2 years in the interim. And we came close, but we did not get to a place where we could find enough compromise to move forward. So we're back to having to comment on the bill as drafted in Senate Bill 915. In addition to moving the amount of reimbursement from the floor of 80% up to 95 to match high schools, and by the way, most charter schools in Oregon are elementary schools, so this would be most of the charter school money. In addition to that state school fund money, the bill also calls for charter schools having access to any local, state, or federal monies received by school districts, which would be local option money, common school fund interest distributions, grants for special programs such as CTE or school improvement, possibly even bond revenues. So even locally generated funds from foundations may be subject to this mandated distribution under Senate Bill 915. We think that's a bridge too far. Also, transportation funds. One of the grants in the general purpose in the state school fund is the transportation grant, and under this bill, charter school students would have access to that, thereby thinning the soup of the transportation grant. So for all of these reasons, we just can't support the bill as drafted, and we remain open to the possibility in the next interim of discussing where there might be some wiggle room to be helpful in this discussion, but not with this vehicle. Thank you.
Okay. Questions? Thank you very much. So now we have Beth Hutchins, Karen Connolly, and Heidi Chow. And I hope I do well with these names. I do acknowledge that I'm dyslexic, and letters and putting them all together phonetically is not always easy for me. So. And whoever wants to start.
Chairman Roblin and members of the Senate Education Committee. My name is Beth Hutchins. I am the manager of Opal School and also the mother of two graduates who are now in college. During my children's lifetime, the World Wide Web was magicked into existence and fits in your pocket. Google processes over 3.5 million billion searches every day, and fake news abounds. How do we teach students to make sense of this flood, to think critically, to prepare for jobs that do not yet exist using technologies that haven't been invented? At Opal School, we are researchers of students and their learning. We are small and nimble, and through innovation and experimentation, we have discovered learning structures that support students to develop the habits of mind that give hope for the future of democracy. Over the past 16 years, we have offered our research in the form of professional development to thousands of teachers and administrators from around the world. This year, we will work with over 700 educators with relationships that stretch over many years and reach into schools with many challenges. These school districts in Oregon include Gladstone, Hillsborough, and Lincoln County. For our research to be robust, our student population must reflect the diversity of our community. Our school can feel out of reach to many families because we do not have the funding to consistently provide beyond the classroom, to provide transportation or aftercare or a nutrition program. We know from experience that the loss of each of these programs directly affects the diversity of our student body. My family's time at Opal School changed my children's lives and changed my life. I wish for all families to have equitable access to those innovative models that are being developed in charter schools. It is our responsibility as leaders to ensure that students across Oregon are treated equitably and that charter school students are valued in the same way as students in district-run schools. I hope that you will support this bill and allow the opportunity for it to be brought to a vote. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Kieran Connolly. I'm the executive director of Trillium Public Charter School in Portland. Today, I'd like to paint a picture for you about what the passing of Senate Bill 915 might mean for our students, or perhaps more accurately, what not passing it might mean for our students. You have heard from some folks and will continue to hear from people about the value of charter schools to students, families, and communities in Oregon. You've heard from Michael, one of our teachers, and in a moment you'll hear from Tajiri, one of our students who came to Trillium and graduated after being on the verge of dropping out of his neighborhood high school, about his experience. At Trillium, we take the edict for charter schools to be both innovative and work with students on the margins of public education very seriously. We do this through fostering education based on critical thinking and community engagement, and using innovative approaches like restorative justice and project-based learning. Oregon has had a charter school law in place since 1999. However, let's be frank, advocates and legislators have tried for years with varying levels of success to fix the inequities that plague the students who choose to attend our schools. Watching all the progressive laws that come out of this legislature, it's hard to understand the lack of attention to the resource inequities students in our charter schools face. Of the 80% ADMW we receive for our K-8 students, we have to pay a mortgage that costs us more than $250,000, or 10% of our budget, a burden that neighborhood schools do not face. We pay into PERS at a rate of 22% of our employee salaries, 18% more than our sponsoring district, which is another 10% of our budget. We're charged 100% of costs for any buses we use for field trips, 70% more than our sponsoring district. Despite these burdens, we continue to invest in our staff, which comprises 72% of our operating budget. In the past 15 years we have existed as a school, it's been a constant struggle just to stay open. We haven't had the money to fix our HVAC system, so our five-year-olds eat lunch in winter coats for most of the year. We can't afford new computers, so our students take their state testing on refurbished hand-me-downs that frequently crash and make the students start over again. Our playground is a parking lot. Our teachers, who we know are the most impactful members of a student's learning experience, are what make our schools functional, develop deep and meaningful relationships with our students. Our teachers work incredibly hard to build safe spaces for them so that they can learn. However, they only stay an average of 3 years before they need to move on to district jobs that pay $15,000 a year more. Our kids do not deserve this. Many of our students are like Tajiri, and not just our high school students. Our first, third, and fifth graders are students that have struggled and not found success at their neighborhood schools. They are at risk of disappearing from our public system entirely. There is no catchment system for these kids. There are almost no options for K-8 students that struggle in their neighborhood schools. Students who often act out behaviorally due to trauma. These are the students that we serve at my school. Yet every year we have to consider whether or not we can afford to stay open. I will go back today, regardless of your decision, and do everything I can to serve kids, kids that our state and education system often want to believe do not exist. But the amount of time that we can continue to do that is finite. If things do not change, we will close our doors and these kids will have nowhere to go. You have the power today to change that. The disparity our students experience is profound. This does not require new funds allocated from you. It does not mean that funds disappear from neighborhood schools. We're not asking for more from other schools than other schools. We are not even asking for the same. We're just asking for enough to not close. And that means 95% of our ADMW. Oregon needs schools like Trillium. We do not turn kids away. We have one of the lowest exclusionary discipline rates in the state, as well as one of the lowest dropout rates in the state. We serve the kids that other schools struggle to serve. You have the power today to ensure that our students have what they need to be successful and flourish in a safe environment. A decision to the counter that could be the one that leaves our most needy students out in the cold. Not giving our students enough money to survive is no different than forcing us to close our doors. Please acknowledge that these kids exist and that they need schools that can serve them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Hard one to follow.
Chairman Roblin and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Heidi Cao, and I'm a parent at the Emerson School, a charter school located in downtown Portland. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 915. I could talk for hours about the Emerson School, about the project approach and how engaging it is, about the focus on positive discipline and how the students are learning to take ownership for their behaviors, or about our test scores, state test scores, and how we continue to excel. However, any discussion of the Emerson School needs to start by talking about its commitment to equity. Equity is such an important topic at Emerson that one out of every four staff meetings is devoted to this topic. And the results can be seen in so many ways, both big and small. You'll notice that 50% of our students identify as students of color. Each year in January, every class studies Martin Luther King Jr., culminating in a day of service and celebration. On the small side, you'll notice that school supplies are communal, which eliminates the financial burden on families that cannot afford to buy supplies. And you'll notice the small way that our kids learn about different cultures. For instance, when my son's class had Project Clay, a guest speaker came in to talk about how clay is used to make lamps for Diwali at the Hindu Festival of Lights. Being a part of Emerson has shaped my kids, but it's also shaped me. My sons, who are interracial, have had the benefit of developing their sense of self in an environment that fully embraces them for who they are. They don't have to hide their Vietnamese heritage to fit in, but they feel pride in their identity. And I, as a Caucasian parent who is raising interracial kids, am continuing to learn about racial equity and how to address it with my kids. When my oldest was in kindergarten, his teacher emailed parents. She told us that she had led us the class in a discussion about race, and they had talked about how talking about race can feel messy. I remember that email to this day, and it helps me when I have to talk about issues of race with my kids to remember that even when I don't have the perfect words, that it's important for me to move forward and talk with them. The biggest barrier that the Emerson School faces in our equity work is that we are limited in our funding and resources by the way that funding is allocated to charter schools. So for instance, all of our families currently have to provide transportation to and from school. The time and money to transport kids to and from downtown Portland each day is prohibitive for many low-income families and limits the economic diversity of our school. Another barrier to equity is that the current funding model doesn't allow us to effectively recruit, retain, or train teachers and staff of colors, and that impacts our ability to effectively recruit, serve, and retain students and families of color. We face many challenges, and Senate Bill funding-wise, but to continue our equity work, we really would ask that Senate Bill 915 move forward, as it would help us to address these issues and help us to create greater equity within our community.
Thank you.
You did a very good job.
Any questions for this group? Nope. Thank you. So next, we're going to go with Tajiri Saunders, and is it Annie Archer, and Sandy Cloud. Tajiri, before you sit down, I just wanted to say thank you to your principal for having said your name ahead of time, because I would never have got it. So whoever wants to go first.
Chairman Roblin, yep. And members of the committee, my name is Tajiri Saunders, and I'm a high school graduate. I stand here today, because without Trillium, I wouldn't have graduated. I attended Trillium from my junior year to my second semester of senior before I attended Roosevelt. I transferred because I found myself too distracted by friends, school events, and outside of school activities. But at Trillium, it was different. Unlike a neighborhood school, Trillium is a community. Everyone from staff to student knows you and wants to see you succeed. It's less distracting for students because classes are smaller and everyone encourages you to use their voice to get the help that you actually need, which helps makes you want to stay in class instead of cut it. Trillium also provides help in self-advocacy. They help me be more comfortable in speaking up for my needs to be successful. I'm living proof without schools like Trillium, like students that don't fit in neighborhood schools won't graduate.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Anise. I'm a fifth grader at David Douglas Arthur Academy. Arthur Academy is a great school. Everyone there is so sweet and kind. Also, charter schools should get the same amount of funding as traditional public schools because we deserve it just as much as they do. Our charter schools excel in learning and will continue to excel as long as we get proper funding. From what I know, charter schools are great schools because they teach students what they need to know and challenge their students in all subjects throughout the year. We also need more funding because charter schools need more supplies for students, unlike a traditional public schools who get more funding. What does a traditional public school have that charter schools don't? I am going to a public charter school. Why don't I get the same amount of funding? In our eyes, we believe all schools, no matter public or charter, and students are all equal.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Great job.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and distinguished members of the Senate Education Committee. My name is Sandy Cloud. I am a parent of two successful charter school graduates, and I am also the coordinator of community relationships for Redmond Proficiency Academy, a charter school located in Central Oregon. When my daughters enrolled in RPA in 2009, our family had very little idea how to navigate preparations for college. I had only recently graduated from college myself, and I knew that the public school system didn't seem like a good fit for what I believed about education. I didn't know how to proceed. RPA, at the time, a little charter school over half an hour away from our home, empowered us to create our own path to our goals. Since being hired by RPA in 2011, I've learned that charter schools have a really unique place in the education system in Oregon. Every charter school has to continue to earn student and family trust, or it will cease to exist. It doesn't matter if they have great ideas about education if they don't deliver great results. RPA did that for my family and many, many more families like mine. It's gone from 150 students that first year. 8 years later, we are at 840 students. It has grown exponentially every year, and our lives will never be the same because of this charter school. Our public charter school offered my girls the ability to take college entrance exams 2 times a year from their freshman year on. They were accelerated through classes that were below their skill level, and they took college courses and AP courses from their freshman year on. My daughters had to develop a plan to use their time in order to take part of all the opportunities that they were given to develop their skills, both academic and social. They and their peers were offered enormous choice of elective courses, including a full slate of performing and visual arts. They were offered chances to serve their peers through RPA's unique ambassador cadre program. Please ask me questions about that later. And to serve community members as well. My oldest daughter, Caitlin, graduated from RPA and was accepted to Southern Oregon University's, at the time, new Honors College, receiving free tuition for the first 2 years that she attended. She was also accepted into NYU's summer program, but was unable to attend because of the high costs. After a while, though, she needed some time away from academic life and went to work bussing dishes in a high-end restaurant that she now, 1.5 years later, has a hand in managing. The owner of the company continues to add to her responsibilities and trusts her to move the company forward using the skills she developed by being given responsibility in our charter school. Interestingly, she recently had a conversation at work with some deaf customers that reminded her how much she loves her RPA American Sign Language class, and so she's given notice at this restaurant, and she's moving to PCC this fall to take their interpreter's class. My youngest daughter, Hannah, graduated from RPA and was offered acceptance to a number of private colleges and universities, including University of Portland, the Madrid campus of Suffolk University, and Smith College. Being overwhelmed at all her options, she chose instead to take a year off of school, save up her money, and do some traveling. This decision culminated in my 19-year-old daughter taking a 2-week trip to Italy all by herself and learning deeply about her ability to set goals and achieve them. Again, these skills had their beginnings in her high school experiences. Currently, she's working part-time while attending COCC and is on the dean's list. The truth is that RPA and other charter schools are here to fill specific student needs. Students who are self-motivated and desire to know themselves and be supported in finding their purpose succeed, indeed thrive, at our charter school. These are the students who will check out of education if they're not given more freedom and responsibility. Our RPA charter school has found one niche to fill that is needed for student success in Oregon. How many other holes might there be that other charter schools could fill if funded properly? I urge you to give SB 915 a work session so that all Oregon students can find their educational path forward. Thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Any questions? I do want to say you win the prize for farthest.
Thank you. Proud of that.
I know you probably studied this, but my high school, my colors have always been purple, so I know that's why you wear purple. I am impressed by that. So it goes to show people who learn, practice, and figure out what to do. So I appreciate it. With that, we'll call up our next group, Richard Donovan and Kristen Miles.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Richard Donovan on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. We have spent a long time. We were part of the work group. We were the conveners of the work group that Senator Roblin referenced to start this hearing on the topic of the bill. Our colleagues in charters and other education stakeholders participated, and you know, I just want to mention that OSBA has 197 school districts as members, but also has 100 charter schools as charter members as well, about 100. As associate members in our association, so we're very much supportive of charters. I think charters have a valuable niche. I think that they add something to the educational system in Oregon. But unfortunately, we're here in opposition to Senate Bill 915 today as drafted. The proponents of the measure, including the students that preceded me, are very persuasive, and they're probably correct. We should probably fund charter schools at a higher rate. Unfortunately, the argument is that, as I've heard, is that look at how valuable what we do is, and I don't argue with that, but I would say that it costs too much. That the impact of this, based upon numbers we have from ODE, would be about a $30 million swing from school districts to charter schools at a time when districts are already looking at cuts of tens of days or thousands of teachers statewide. And if this were a different scenario, if we're having a different conversation, a conversation around revenue or a conversation about QM funding,
we might be able to support the bill or at least not oppose it, but today, unfortunately, I have to come up here and tell you that the districts cannot be in support of this bill, and I will leave the specifics of charter and charter operations to my colleague, Kristen.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Kristen Miles, and I'm a board development specialist at OSBA. I've also spent about the last decade working with charter schools and districts on charter schools, so thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak to you about Senate Bill 915. Each biennium, all OSBA or OSBA members, including members of all 197 districts in Oregon, vote to adopt legislative priorities. And these priorities are the foundation of our legislative activities during the session. Some of our priorities, as chosen by our members for the 2017-18 biennium, include stable and adequate funding for districts, local control, and opposition to any unfunded mandates. Unfortunately, Senate Bill 915 does not meet these priorities. As you are all too acutely aware, funding for education is far from being finalized. And as Richard mentioned, there are already districts that are looking at cuts, both to staff and days, sometimes both. We all know that the funding pie is getting no bigger. And according to info that we have from ODE, the bill would shift approximately $30 million from districts to charter schools. This shift would cause districts to make even deeper cuts than they're already planning and would cause them to probably reduce services and supports to their charter schools. However, we do believe that there are opportunities for meaningful collaboration between school districts and charter schools in the future, including some of the things that we had talked about during this work session, which OSBA, or work group, which OSBA was a part of, and that would be ESD services to charter schools, district pass-through of grant and program funding to charter schools, and including charter school transportation costs as part of the reimbursable district transportation costs. So we look forward in the future to working collaboratively on these issues with charter schools, and we're happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So we're down to the last four. So I think we'll do it in groups of two so no one has to sit up there by themselves. And we'll go with Sue Haas and John Nelson.
Hello, Chairman Roblin, members of the Senate Education Committee. My name is Sue Haas, and I have two sons at the Opal Charter School, where Beth was from four. My oldest son has autism. When we started looking at elementary schools for him, we didn't have a formal diagnosis for my son, but we knew he struggled with basic social interactions. We worked hard to foster connections between him and other children through community activities, but without a consistent set of peers, his progress was limited. When we discovered Opal Charter School's social-emotional curriculum with its focus on healthy conflict resolution, we thought it might be a stretch for him, but ultimately we decided that it would be a great opportunity for him to become a part of a supportive community where he could work on developing those social skills. Over the years, I have seen his ability to connect with others increase in ways I never imagined. I hear from parents how their children benefit from experiences that they have as a result of my son's full inclusion in the classroom. I see my younger son use Opal strategies to make deep connections with his brother that far surpass my expectation of how any siblings would interact, let alone a pair, including one child with autism. My hope is that we can afford these sorts of opportunities to families who currently can't access a charter school, so that more families who can't provide their own transportation to a charter school or who require before and after care services or whose children depend on free and reduced lunches as part of their children's school day can access a charter school whose mission speaks to them the way that the Opal Charter School mission spoke to my family. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the Education Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today in support of SB 915. My name is John Nelson. I'm a lifelong Oregonian, a career advocate for equity in public education. I have four children and two grandchildren. I've served three terms on my local school board, Reynolds School District. Most of that time I spent in leadership. For the past 20 years, I've been a strong advocate for school choice and primarily, generally and more specifically, for charter schools in the state of Oregon. I'm currently the executive director of Nova Learning Public Charter School. Nova is a majority low-income and majority racial minority school serving about 400 kids in East Multnomah County's Rockwood community. like most kids, Nova's kids, students come to school excited to learn new things, gain new skills, and build dreams for the future. Unlike most kids in Oregon, Nova students come from a community that's deeply scarred by poverty, violence, and substance abuse. Still, even when facing levels of poverty, joblessness, domestic violence, abuse, exposure to drugs and alcohol, Nova families are making the proactive choice to send their kids to our charter school rather than the traditional schools in our neighborhood. Today I speak for those children and those families. Today I ask, what about these children? Is little Miguel at my school really only worth 80% of what the kid, little Billy next door, gets at his local traditional school? Is little Tasha not worthy of the same level of resources as the child living in the apartment next to her? You know, where is the moral and ethical defendable argument that makes the current inequity okay or anything less than institutionalized protectionism? Here's the truth. 20 years ago, when Oregon's charter school law was written, lobbyists representing OEA, COSA, OSBA, the same folks that are in this room right now, were successful in lobbying for charter school funding and sponsorship provisions that protected the traditional schools and made it establishing a charter school nearly impossible. I know I was starting some of those early charter schools. Or better yet, just discourage people from trying in the first place. Still, they rise. 126 charter schools in Oregon now. Each charter school is unique in the delivery model and the community that they serve. Sadly, all Oregon charter schools have one unacceptable common reality. Students in Oregon charter schools are seen by the law as less worthy of funding support than students in the orthodox system. SB 915 is a chance. It's a chance to fix the inequity that we cooked into the law many, many years ago. It's a chance for the legislature to demonstrate to the people of Oregon that it really, truly values equity. In short, it's a chance to do the right thing for our kids. Please do the right thing by moving this this important bill forward. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for being here. Any questions? And our last two, Casey Jolsonet and Darla Musewison. I don't know how to say those names. Too many consonants and vowels for a person who can't
deal with Dutch. Them.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Senator Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Casey Jolisant. I am a parent of two children at Savvy Island Academy, a charter school on Savvy Island, and I am also the vice chair of the SIA school board. As a parent, I have two kids who are thriving in the place-based curriculum. It is ideal for them, both engaging them in their community, in their studies, in their education, and it helps them see their impact on the world around them. As a board member, I daily see teachers, students, staff, our administrator, parents, and members of the community at large working together to create a creative and innovative learning environment. I know that with all schools right now, funding is an issue. But the 80% of funding that charter school students receive creates an inequity that is hurting public school children. We forget that charter school students are public school children. I think that others have spoken to the facilities, the teachers, and other costs given that charter schools experience. What I want to talk about is the original 80-20% split that was conceived when charter schools began in the state of Oregon. At that time, there was a doubt to how much this would cost the districts. Nobody wanted to see the districts putting out more money to charter schools and losing money on this endeavor. At the same time, regulations were not as great at that time. It was not expected that charter schools would have to follow the same rules as regular traditional district schools. What we see now is that it doesn't take 20% to cover the district's administration costs, not even close. And the regulatory requirements that we are under have increased each year, and funding has not. I would venture to say that Senate Bill 915 would be a win for everyone in the state of Oregon, all public school children. Public school children attending charter schools would receive equitable funding to pay for all those things that make our schools great. The 5% that districts would still retain would be plenty to compensate the district for their administrative costs. Nobody wants to see the districts putting out money that get costing districts money. Nobody wants to see that. The 5% would cover that. Equitable funding helps ensure that every public student in the state will find the best educational option for them, and as a result, the best choice of success for all public school students, charter and traditional. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin and Education Committee, thank you for letting me be here today. I'm going to piggyback on what Casey said a little bit. 1999.
I know Casey, but we don't know your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Darla Meeson. And I'm the director of Savvy Island Academy. And in 1999, as I understand it, you all worked really hard together. There's many of you in this building, in the audience, who participated in that. I was not part of that, but I have gleaned some of the benefits of the hard work that you did in 1999. When I talk to people about charter schools, how it came about, everyone can agree that the goals and the intent were creativity, innovative, a model of catalysts, different learning styles, innovative, all of those things everyone can agree on, and I think still to this day agree on. And when I look at the ORS, there's very little, if any, amendments that have been made to the intent or goals of what charter schools are. When this agreement was made 18 years ago, the agreement was that we would be funded less. I admit that. The agreement was 80-20. But part of that agreement, which I hear oftentimes brought up by school districts and other individuals, you know, in conversation like this, is that, well, but charter schools have less requirements. And as Casey spoke, I started to go through the ORS to look at how many different amendments and dates that are in the ORS. And every year, more and more and more gets put onto charter schools. Last year, House Bill 2186 brought us into the same evaluation system as district schools. PE minutes, healthy and safe schools with radon, water testing, Aaron's Law with child abuse and sex abuse curriculums. If you look right now, I did it last night on the legislative site, there's 34 bills that mention charter schools. And so every year, it gets whittled away at what the idea was, as I understand it, was that there was less funding for it because you had less mandates and less requirements, less reporting and so forth. But let's be realistic. As we have evolved over 18 years, that has become less and less. And for me to put a new evaluation system in, that costs money, that costs time, that costs resources. You know, school districts had 3 or 4 years to implement it. They got grants that helped them with some of those things. We got 1 year, no monies, no grants, but told to do it. And none of the things that I see being passed are bad for kids. Do I think that our kids should have, you know, lead in the water? No. But pest management, ELL plans, all of these things take resources, they take time, they take money. And so to say, well, over 18 years we've evolved, we've added, at least acknowledge, we've added all of these things to your plate. And that costs money and time and people. And so the next thing that hurdle, if you get past that in the conversation, is enrollment. Well, when charter schools were originally came in 1999, we knew that that could potentially draw down enrollment for school districts. And how are we going to come up with that money that they're losing to charter schools and the enrollment? And nobody, I don't think, in 1999 predicted that open enrollment would pass in 2011. But it did. Open enrollment passed. And so now, districts have the ability to fill the positions lost to charter schools. So roundabout numbers in our district, 150 kids from the district come to the charter school. That opens up about 150 positions for them in their district through open enrollment. And they do it, and it's great. And there's 150 more kids who are being served in a way that meets their needs. And so this idea that this money is now lost, I would say we need to evolve and look at that, because now they've got open enrollment plus the 20% that they're receiving from charter schools. So I would again say 18 years, things have changed. Should we be looking at this percentage of 80-20? If you get past those two things, you get to oversight. Like Casey said, nobody says it doesn't cost to have charter schools. You know, I work with the superintendent, student services, business manager, human resources, facilities. I work with all of these people in the district. Now, 5%, I did a quick study of their of the salaries, and if I took all those people times 5%, comes out to be about 40 grand. 20% of our, or 5% of our funding is about 90 grand. So that's twice what it potentially just on paper, right? Like, let's be realistic, could cost. So 5%, that's 2 hours a week that I work with each of those people. Probably not. But in a year when we're negotiating our contract, absolutely. There can be more. It ebbs and flows. Nobody says that there isn't a cost. But could we at least, after 18 years, come back and evaluate that 80-20 ratio? Because it doesn't seem logistic. It doesn't seem to be accurate anymore, looking at 18 years of evidence. If you get past that, you get to licensed teachers. Charter schools can hire anyone they want off the street, 50%, anyone they want, right? Nobody in their right minds is going to do that.
But hurry.
Yes.
We're a little late already.
Sure. No one in their right mind is going to do that on purpose. You know, we if you hire someone that's not licensed, it's because you can't afford or there's no one available that is. But we see school districts all the time put people on conditional licenses for special ed, for voc positions, for subs. And so this idea that we're the only ones that can use people that are non-licensed, I would disagree. I think there are means and mechanisms that allow districts, that allow public charter schools to do that same thing. And then members, I appreciate OSBA being here and COSA and the union. We participate in that. Like he said, 100 of us are part of OSBA and part of COSA. And some of us have unions. Some of us participate. Other people participate in unions. 18 years ago, if you asked the people in the room if they ever thought that charters would be a part of those agencies, I don't think they would have thought that, right? But it has evolved. When I hear COSA, and I appreciate them recognizing our participation in it, but to hear them say like $30 million would be taken from public education because of this bill, I would say, well, isn't the reality that $30 million is already being taken from public education? It's just being taken from the charter school side. And so I would ask that you, I know you said that you weren't going to move this bill forward, but I guess I would ask that you look at things that have evolved in 18 years and please be willing to look at the percentage and see if it too needs to evolve for equity and for kids. I think they deserve it, and we owe it to them to do that.
Thank you. Any questions? I guess what I would want to say something.
Well, the point, the argument is well made in terms of how we manage the resources, the innovation that come from private schools. We as the education committee will have to recognize and understand we're not even talking about virtual schools, but the territorial monopoly that exists in a school boundary. That's why open enrollment exists today, because that territorial monopoly is so fragile. The territorial monopoly in school districts also exists and will get bombarded with virtual. These are just innovative local schools, very much smaller, lower overhead, lower administrative costs, lower capital and we as the Education Committee really have to get a handle on this. You and I joined together to sponsor this Bill 915 because we think the time is right to kind of put this idea on the street. I would love to see the opportunity to move it forward.
Thank you. So I guess I'll make the final statements because I have the gavel, so I get to do that. So I will say that in 1999, when the conversations were going on, I have always been a charter school fan for a lot of reasons. And in my own school, at my own high school, we formed two charter schools in the school grounds because I really believe that the basic premise for charter schools is a good one. New inventive ways to deal with kids, right? And so I will always support that. The 80-40 split, one of the things we, 80-95, the two different numbers that happened for charter schools, I think we need to look at it. And I agree with you, and I thank you for the idea that we need to make, really have a real deep conversation about it. Because it wasn't just because that's what we could do in 1999. There was a lot of thought that was put into it. If you are in a regular school district, I happen to be a high school principal. When you take all the money that comes in from all the kids, the high school, we got about 110, 115% per kid. So our kids cost more, so the district gave us more money. And you know where that money came away from? It came from the elementary schools. So they were in it less expensive to run than the high schools. And so when we say 80%, you're getting 80% of what other kids, if we need to look closely to see what is the average around the state now for that proportion of money that comes to the districts that represents elementary, middle school, and high school? Because each one of them takes a different proportion. When a school district gets money, they get money in the form of per kid, and then they have to balance that out. And so we don't spend 100% of the money we get in for our elementary kids. I just want to tell people we don't. And I don't know of any school district that does. Is it 80%? I don't know that. That was an estimate that was made at the time, which I think was, from my perspective as a high school principal looking at what I was going to have to do, I would say that was probably close because you don't have half the kids in the high school getting the 120%. You've got a proportion of them. So what I'll tell you today is that I am, and there's other monies that come into school districts that don't go to charter schools. That's mentioned in the school. So I think we have to look at all of that. In the interim, we will put together some people to have a conversation. I will talk to some very smart people at the Department of Education who know where all the money is going and how much it's spent, and we'll start having some conversations on what is that actual number as an average across the state that is spent on elementary, middle school, and high schools. We'll have those conversations, and we'll meet with all the different people that are here in this room, and I appreciate the sincerity and the thoughtfulness that went into everybody's conversation today. So hopefully we can use this to build on something to have a real conversation. I appreciated what somebody said about transportation. School districts get reimbursed at a fairly high rate. So if there's a way, we need to figure out what we can do and how we can deal with some of those kind of things. But each one of those is a thing that we really have to look at carefully so that we don't disadvantage one side or the other. And I believe that the people who were trying to put together in this state in 1999 a program that made this work came there sincerely. There were some that didn't want it, from the very beginning. There are others that were advocates that only wanted it. So, I mean, it was a lot of people talking who spent a lot of time trying to come up with something that was right. It has been 18 years. It's probably time to have a look at all of that. So that's the only thing I will commit to you today, because I'm not going to work this bill. But I just want to be clear with everybody that from my perspective, it's the thing that drives me, is that we need to try to figure out how we help every child in Oregon get the best education they can have. And that could be a homeschool student to a charter school student. They're all Oregon's kids. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 9:15. And thank you all. And I think we're done. Done with the business today, so we're going to close the Education Committee today.